This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of February 26th, here are a few top stories. In the news, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody and Casey Kuhn.
The governing board of Arizona's and the country's largest community college district met last night and heard from angry employees, current and former, on several recently made decisions. From KJZZ's education desk, Casey Kuhn was there last night and joins me now here in studio. Casey, good morning.
Good morning.
So up for a vote last night was getting rid of a policy called Meet and Confer. What exactly is that and what did people have to say about it?
So Meet and Confer is basically a kind of bargaining tool that faculty can use to discuss how employees are paid, how the working environment kind of goes, and things like that. So last night, the board voted to eliminate that program. Their justification was that to eliminate this, it kind of streamlines the decision-making process at that top level. And it was not, as I'm sure you can imagine, welcomed with open arms by the staff. The meeting room was actually at capacity, so they had to open a conference room over in the district building next door to accommodate all the overflow of people who wanted to say something.
Now, Casey, staff isn't happy, but after the board met last week to talk about this initially, the board president said some faculty were, quote, fear-mongering when people started to get worried about their jobs. How did the board members vote and why?
Right. So last night, the choice to cut the program passed 4-3. It wasn't unanimous. There were several amendments, several substitute motions that were discussed, but ultimately most were shot down until that final vote. Most vocally opposed. Some did vocally oppose the decision. Linda Thor called it shameful, a dark day for the district. She was pretty much quiet, though, up until that roll call vote to explain her vote. And then the board president, Lauren Hendricks, voted to eliminate this policy. He said, and all the public comment that we heard about it last night was pretty much against it. I saw online opposition as well. But Hendricks says faculty will not see any significant changes. And he thinks only a small but very vocal group is against it. Here he is.
If they were aware of the actual factual information, I don't think we'd have the concern. I don't think the morale problem is real. It's being propagated by a minority of members. I think the majority are happy with their jobs. I don't think they're afraid of what happened tonight.
Of course, here's a double negative. I did not hear anyone that was not against cutting the policy.
All right. Last week, that meeting was chaotic and probably confusing in some ways for people who are worried their jobs at the community colleges would be compromised. Did that happen this time, and how did the governing board explain their votes?
So, a lot of people came out to speak against this policy cut, but it was relatively subdued. There were several moments when the crowd would kind of clap or react to a certain comment. For example, board member Tracy Livingston explained her vote. She said this type of policy didn't work at other school districts that she had helped manage on governing boards there, and said something about the staff's reaction, making the board out to be villains. And of course, everybody started clapping. She said she walked right into that one. She did. One faculty member from Scottsdale Community College, actually, Rhonda McDonald, says the morale problem is real. She doesn't trust the board, and she says this policy actually helped keep faculty motivated to help students.
At Scottsdale, we have a long history of faculty going above and beyond what they're paid to do. But we've just been told, in no clearer words, that that sort of dedication is not valued and it's not rewarded.
I did hear some responses, mostly from the board, that said that people were saying the policy is flawed, but that it should be fixed and not cut entirely. Ultimately, this decision is supposed to save the district money while also moving the decision-making process along.
Now, the community college district has been taking a lot of hits after this and also after cutting the football program at schools that had it, which we've reported on as well. Did that come up last night?
Oh, yes. In fact, a group of people came out to protest that elimination last night. You're kind of seeing a pattern here, right? One coach from the Scottsdale football program, the Fighting Artichokes, said this policy decision came without any input or any consideration from the people who actually work with those players and students. Junior college football is kind of seen as a last step for players who didn't make it to a four-year college. And that same coach also said that this football decision will impact a population that's mostly minority students. And you could even hear the protests going on from inside the meeting room as the board was voting to cut another policy.
All right. That's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn. Casey, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And we should, of course, note that KJZZ is licensed to the Maricopa County Community College District.
Can we love the Grand Canyon too much? Two National Geographic reporters explored the canyon and spoke with the show's Mark Brody.
Arizona is, of course, the Grand Canyon State, and the national park is considered a crown jewel of the system. But the park and the canyon itself are facing challenges. Writer Kevin Fedarko and photographer and filmmaker Pete McBride will be speaking about some of them tonight at the Mesa Art Center as part of the National Geographic Live Series. Their presentation is called Between River and Rim, Hiking the Grand Canyon, and they did just that, hike the whole thing. They're with me to talk about their experience and what they learned. And Pete, first off, what prompted you guys to do this?
I'd actually done a project on the length of the Colorado River, and Kevin had actually done a project on the Grand Canyon, and I think we were both done with that area of our work. But I came to do a talk at the Grand Canyon, the South Rim, and everyone was talking about how there's a lot of challenges the place is facing, and so I went and knocked on his door and wanted to see if he'd want to join me on an unusual project.
Kevin, as Pete said, you both had been in that area quite a bit. Were you looking for something different on this particular visit?
I think in some ways we were. We were both very familiar with the world of the Grand Canyon, but from the perspective of the Colorado River. And I think at the heart of Pete's idea was the notion that the river itself is controlled by two enormous dams. It's largely a system of plumbing that sustains the Southwest. And if you want to really experience the essence of the wilderness inside of Grand Canyon National Park, what you have to do is leave the edges of the river and move into this very complex and very brutal world between the river and the rims. And that was the center and the focus of our walk through the canyon.
What did you guys find when you were doing that? Because I would imagine that some of these areas are not super well visited.
They're not. Over 70% of it, there's no trail. What we first found is that the canyon respects nobody. It doesn't matter how much experience you've had. This place beats you down. There's a reason it instills humility. So it's actually much harder than I anticipated on probably a 10x scale.
Really?
Just figuring your way through it, finding how to get to water, keep moving through these lateral layers of rock. But we also found some remarkable beauty, some amazing, amazing archaeology, spectacular wildlife, and I think for both of us, one of the richest discoveries was the level of silence that is hard to describe until you've experienced it.
It's interesting because you hear a lot that people will go to a place like the Grand Canyon to kind of get away. You know, national parks are often seen as a place to get outside, get away, leave your cell phone behind. But even at the Grand Canyon, at least in the touristy areas, it's not all that quiet. You really got silence. Like, it must have been almost deafening.
It was so silent at times that my microphones were not working properly because they're calibrated to a noisier world, to a noisier silence. So it was hard to believe. And yes, our parks are facing a lot of visitation and there's places that they seem crowded, but it doesn't take much effort. You don't have to hike 800 miles through Grand Canyon to experience this. You can discover it in a variety of ways.
Kevin, what do you think you took away from having done this hike as far as helping you understand some of the challenges that the Grand Canyon is facing?
I think what the hike enabled us to do was, in a way, to kind of take an inventory of the treasures that are contained within the crown jewel of our national park system and to get a sense of what places look like and how they will be impacted by developments that now hang over the Grand Canyon, loom over the canyon, and threaten, I think, to damage at a rather profound level the integrity of the landscape itself. I think it's probably fair to say that Pete and I were both haunted as we walked through the canyon by a sense that we were experiencing these places not only for the first, but perhaps for the last time as well, right? Because I think if some of these projects come in, it will probably be impossible for us ever to return to them. I think, for me at least, it will be necessary for me to hold those places in my mind and remember them as I saw them at the time rather than what they may become.
You think some of the proposed projects pose that big of a problem, that big of a challenge to the canyon?
They absolutely do. It's no overstatement to say that Grand Canyon National Park is literally ringed by, from every cardinal point of the compass, by developments that will change it in ways that will be enormously impactful and negative. And that what you are able to see and what you were able to experience today may not be the case in the future. And what that really goes to is the question of whether or not we may be in danger of breaking the covenant that we have as a nation to take these places within our national park system, Grand Canyon being one, places to which we have made the commitment collectively to preserve and protect and pass along intact to future generations of Americans. And that may no longer be the case with Grand Canyon.
Pete, which of the proposals are most problematic to you? Which are the ones that you're most concerned about?
I think there's a host of them that collectively are creating a situation of a death by a thousand cuts scenario. There's not one project, like historically there was a dam, two dams proposed inside Grand Canyon which people could rally around. Right now there's we identify four. The main one is the Grand Escalade, which is a tramway that would extend on the Navajo land, bring up to 10,000 people a day down to the confluence, which is believed to be a very sacred area by many native tribes in the area. It's dividing the Navajo Nation over it. It's recently been set back by some recent votes, but it's still on the table. I think that is an example of how this could change, but currently there is a development on the west, which has come up recently. Helicopter air tours have grown exponentially, and I'm not against flying or air tours. It's just the rate of growth, the commercial tourism that's happened. There's now up to 400 flights a day, and the collective noise and the economic engine that is there is reverberating east up through the canyon, and the other tribes are saying, well, we want a piece of that too. And if everyone comes to the table at that scale, that silence, the night sky, the tranquility, it's all going to vanish.
Well, how do you balance that, though, between trying to preserve what's there and the beauty and the silence that is there now, but also allowing tribes especially to try to, you know, increase their economic development and make things a little bit better for their people?
The balance is the question. That's the huge challenge, of course. We all want to see this place, and how we don't love it to death is the big question. I think at the heart of it is that there's a lot of different interest groups around the canyon, and we need to create a larger conversation. There are a lot of silos, including the native tribes, the 11 native tribes that surround the park. And we need conversations with the national park, all the tribes, all the constituencies that have an interest in this place, and work together on this. Because at the end of the day, yes, it's a national park, and people think this is the most protected piece of landscape in the world, but it's not. It's fragile, and it's we need to have a serious conversation on how this moves forward so we don't willy-nilly change this place.
All right. Pete, Kevin, thanks a lot for coming in, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a bunch.
Photographer and filmmaker Pete McBride and writer Kevin Fedarko will be speaking tonight at the Mesa Art Center as part of the National Geographic Live series. Their presentation is called Between River and Rim, Hiking the Grand Canyon.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In education news, Scottsdale Unified School District Superintendent Denise Birdwell was put on leave last week following a conflict of interest investigation. Now the district is moving forward. From the KJZZ Education Desk, Mariana Dale reports.
The governing board met with legal counsel behind closed doors for more than 10 hours Tuesday. The meeting's agenda included several ongoing issues in the district, from the decision to place the superintendent on leave to the attorney general's investigation. The state's top prosecutor filed a lawsuit last week, claiming the district broke procurement law relating to several bond-funded projects. The governing board voted Tuesday to cease construction at Hohokam Elementary and at a centralized kitchen. The board also named District Administrator Amy Fuller acting superintendent. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Scottsdale.
From Science News. Why do women get an abortion? That's one of the questions Arizona lawmakers want answered under a proposed law that would expand what abortion providers have to tell the state. Opponents of the measure say it's just one more way to limit access to the procedure. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
Serena Canarum never planned on being a teenage mother.
It was difficult. I was 19 raising a one-year-old.
So when she got pregnant again, she made a difficult choice.
I was on birth control, using condoms. I did not want to have another child. I did everything right.
Kanaram, now 36, decided to get an abortion. It wasn't easy.
I ran for the safety of the clinic, and someone threw a doll covered in synthetic blood at me and called me a murderer.
If Kanaram sounds calm, it's because she deals with this regularly. She volunteers for Planned Parenthood Arizona, escorting women into the clinics. Many are scared, like she was, but there are differences.
Now they have to go through these 1 through 10 of things that, you know, informed consent and ultrasounds and all of these things that are, again, intrusions into their lives.
Arizona's abortion laws are among the most restrictive in the country. Women must undergo an ultrasound, receive state-directed counseling, wait 24 hours. Now a proposed law may add more to that list, asking women why they're getting the procedure.
This is not going to stop one woman from having an abortion.
Kathy Harrod is president of the conservative Center for Arizona Policy and helped craft Senate Bill 1394.
The point of 1394 is to update Arizona's abortion reporting laws so that better data means better services for women that are considering an abortion.
Under the proposal, providers would have to run down a list. Questions like, is the woman's emotional health at stake? Physical health? Does she not want children at this time? Is it because of relationship issues? The final option, unknown, or the woman refused to answer. Existing law already asks for a reason. Harrod says including this list refines the data, making it easier to compile.
This should be the simplest, most common ground issue in the abortion area. Instead, the abortion industry in Arizona, as well as the medical community, has decided that for some reason they're going to be hysterical over this bill.
No, it's not their business. It's a private matter between the doctor and the patient.
That's Dr. Gabrielle Goodrick, who runs an abortion clinic in Phoenix.
It's about shaming and it's about exposure and getting information that is not relevant.
The bill also requires providers to report where the abortion was performed, the doctor's medical specialty, the referring physician, as well as an expanded list of possible complications.
My question to them, if they're concerned about women's health, why aren't they concerned about the rising of maternal mortality? They don't even get this data from hospitals about live births or cesarean sections.
A study from the University of California, San Francisco looked at more than 50,000 women who had abortions and found the rate of major complications is about 2%, on par with colonoscopies. In Arizona, there were more than 13,000 abortions in 2016, according to state numbers, and just 33 complications. Goodrick says only a handful of abortion providers are left in the state, and each new law makes it more difficult to stay open.
Over and over again for the past 10 years, it has been paperwork after paperwork. It is an undue burden on the providers, and it adds cost and burden to the patients, as all these regulations do.
So far, the bill is widely opposed by the Arizona medical community, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. But Harrod says that doesn't tell the full story.
Certainly we had pregnancy center people who supported. You know, have I gone out and looked for an obstetrician gynecologist to take their time away from their busy schedules to say, hey, would you come down and testify? Would you take time out of delivering babies, out of taking care of women to come testify on a simple abortion reporting bill? Yeah, you know, I'm just not going to do, there's not a need for that.
She says the bill isn't onerous. It's modeled off laws in Oklahoma, a red state, and Minnesota, a blue state. But Elizabeth Nash, with the pro-reproductive rights research group, the Guttmacher Institute, says this bill isn't about public health. We spoke via Skype.
The idea of asking a woman the reason for the abortion is not considered something that the CDC included in its standard abortion reporting form.
And given its wide support among Republican lawmakers, it may soon be required in Arizona. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And finally, from the Fronteras Desk. When it comes to immigration, we generally speak about people moving here into the U.S., but what about those leaving the country? According to the Mexican census, there are about 250,000 people in that country who were born in the United States but haven't been officially registered in either place. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports on a woman born in Phoenix now living like an undocumented immigrant in Mexico.
Have you been to the MVD lately? It's crowded, it's stuffy.
Siga formada, señora.
The Mexican equivalent is no better. There's a guy whose job it is to keep people standing in line. And figuratively, Daniela Silva has been stuck here for years.
Silva, my name is Daniela Silva Bascal.
Back in 1996, Silva's parents were living in Mesa, and her dad was working at a tire disposal company.
And where were you born?
Phoenix, Arizona.
And shortly after she was born, Silva's parents brought her to their native state of Puebla.
I'm from Mexico. Es que ya me siento de aquí, completamente. Entonces estoy.
Silva says she feels Mexican, but like her parents were in the U.S., she doesn't have proper documentation. She can't legally work, pay taxes, or vote. She found out when she was applying for public university. She logged onto the admissions page, and it told her that she's classified as a foreigner.
Ahí aparece como documento migratorio el mío. Entonces, ahí fue cuando cambió todo.
That's when everything changed, she says. The application for international students would cost her more than 30 times what her classmates paid. All because her parents hadn't been able to register her as a Mexican citizen when they moved back 22 years ago.
So this is a really complicated and common problem.
Jillian Wagman is an attorney with the Institute for Women in Migration, a nonprofit in Mexico City. Government statistics show that in recent years, more people have returned to Mexico than the other way around. One challenge for parents is in transferring and translating birth certificates. Another one is proving the certificate is legitimate in the first place. For that, you need an official seal called an apostille.
It is a word in English. You can get an apostille in the United States. The entity that issued the document issues apostilles. We just never use them in the United States.
The easiest way to get this seal is for the parent to get it in person, if they're still in the U.S. Wagman says transferring someone's identity to Mexico is a 10-step process that can take years.
If the family doesn't have a copy of the child's birth certificate,
parent going to get their birth
and
certificate
then signing the amendment form in front of a notary
to get an apostille nationality here in Mexico.
I'm really sorry. I think I like went unconscious through that explanation.
It's really complicated.
Wagman says this would be more manageable if local American governments made children's documents more accessible to their parents, or if Mexican authorities were more flexible. In Mexico City, the Civil Registry Office is likely the city's busiest bureaucracy, says Director Claudia Luengas Escudero.
Es una guerra al subregistro.
Luengas says registering adult Mexican citizens is an ongoing battle. The most recent estimate says that in the city alone, more than 1.5 million people never got birth certificates.
Todos los días tenemos brigadistas que tocan puerta por puerta.
Luenga says city officials go out daily trying to register people. In some cases, the father denied paternity. In others, the parents themselves never had ID. The undocumented children of Mexican parents are simply not a priority. And it's not like they would get deported anywhere anyway.
No es delito. Incluso a quien perjudica más es a la persona no registrada.
Not having a birth certificate is not a crime, Luenga says. Daniela Silva has a birth certificate issued by the Arizona Department of Health Services. She just hasn't been able to regularize her status in Mexico because her certificate hadn't been apostilled by the Arizona Secretary of State.
Estado de Arizona, Departamento del Estado.
A few months ago, Silva's father met a Mexican-American lawyer at the country club where he's a waiter, and the lawyer offered to help pro bono. The lawyer brought them the birth certificate just last week.
Pero lo importante era esto, nada más.
With the apostilled birth certificate in hand, Silva may now be able to prove her Mexican citizenship. She says what she cares about the most is being able to study and get a job where she grew up. She says that maybe someday visiting the Grand Canyon would be nice. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, reporting from Puebla, Mexico.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.